he said, "Sandy, you know, I got this property, and you could take it if you'd like and see if you could turn it into a TV show or a movie, and, you know, we'll let you have a great credit, something like a producer, executive producer. I think this property could be great. I think it could be fantastic. It's got a lot of potential for movies, for television, for merchandising." I said, "Okay, Stan, what's the property?" He said, "Oh, it's called X-Men."
If someone offered me X-Men on a plate, I would give them in return my kidneys, my spleen, my vinyl collection, my child, my undying love and appreciation. I would certainly leave my partner, "Sorry, honey," and I would go streaking through the woods, screaming nonsensical words at the top of my lungs. Television writer Sandy Fries did none of these things.
So, yeah, I remember reading X-Men as a kid. This was a nice comic book, very good comic book. So he said, "Stan, I'll think about it and see if I want to take on X-Men and turn it into a TV show or a movie or whatever." And after lunch, I left him with the message that I'd get back to him, give him a call, after I thought about the X-Men suggestion he had. And what happened was I completely forgot about it. So the X-Men fell through my hands, all of them, and I didn't do anything about it. I just totally forgot.
Stan Lee's history with Marvel is seen as rather controversial. There are many clashing stories about who should get credit where in the Marvel Universe. But what is undeniable is Stan was the poster man for an industry that fought for decades to be taken seriously. It was his out-of-the-box thinking that brought our childhood fantasies across our screens. He was a mentor and a friend to his readers, a pioneer in comic book publishing, a visionary, and he had a smile that could melt any foe that confronted him. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Stanley Martin Lieber was born in Manhattan on December 28th in 1922. His father was a tailor and his mother was a housewife. During the Great Depression, Stan's father lost his job. He used the family savings and opened a diner, but sadly, it was also unsuccessful. They moved to a small apartment in Washington Heights with his younger brother, Larry. The apartment had only one window, but it created a blank slate for Stan's imagination to start brewing. He was an exceptionally smart kid. He skipped grades and won the New York Herald Tribune's essay contest 3 times in a row. He preferred reading classics like Sherlock Holmes and Treasure Island over the few comics available for children at the time. And he loved movies, especially action and fantasy. It was in high school when Stan was more well known for his nickname, Stan Lee. As the family struggled to make ends meet, Stan quickly learned the value of a stable job. After graduating high school in 1939, Stan began looking for work. He wanted to become the next great American novelist, and he was trying to find a way to be involved in the business while supporting his family. He started writing obituaries before he found the role that would set him up for the rest of his life. Martin Goodman was a distant relative who worked as a magazine publisher. He published timely comics, and he needed a helper. Goodman didn't take comics seriously and allowed Stan to have free rein in the office. His main tasks were running errands and filling artists' ink pots, but he was diligent and he worked his way up in the office. Alan Bellman was an artist at Timely Comics and worked with Stan for many years.
Stan was green, as green as I was when I joined the organization. But as you work and learn and you become more acclimated to what you do and your work improves, and Stanley along the same line, his knowledge and improved. He was more sure of himself now as he was, you know, in the beginning he was not so sure of himself, but that in time that develops, it acclimates you to a professional. And as far as Stanley, He was pretty nice to work for, and I gave him the respect that he deserved.
His first short story was published in an issue of Captain America. Eventually, he was able to develop his own character, and in 1941, he developed the Destroyer in the Mystic Comics series. The character was very similar to Captain America. They were both Nazi-fighting superheroes who gained power after being injected with a mysterious elixir. Shortly after releasing this book, he became the editor of Timely Comics. He was 19. When World War II broke out, Stan Lee enlisted in the Army in 1942. He was posted stateside as a playwright. He wrote training manuals and created instructional films. When he returned, he dove straight back into writing and editing comics. They did war stories, romance stories, humor stories, horror stories, monster stories, animated animal comic stories. Whatever was the trend at the moment, that's what they did. Alan Bellman remembers the shenanigans his colleagues would get up to in the office to release some tension.
We had the animators. They drew Silly Seal and Ziggy Pig. We had Al Jaffe, who made his name at Mad Magazine. He worked in the animators' room. We were in the illustrators' room. We were the more serious artists while the animators worked on, animated type characters. Oh, they were crazy, the animators. This Al Jaffe used to creep in on his hand and feet and give the nearest artist a hot foot. Now, what is a hot foot? You take a pack of matches, pull one match out, you put it in the sole of the shoe, and you then light one until the artist feels the heat and says, ouch. But that was, they had a different type of sense of humor. If one day, we were working in the Empire State Building at the time, and they were next room to us, and I saw this cardboard animated figure. They were operating from their window. In those days, you know, we could open the window in the Empire State Building. We had the glass. We did not have air conditioning because it was all during the war. And they were operating this character. It was really funny. They did have a sense of humor. But some of them were very mean and not nice.
Comics were not seen as a legitimate industry at the time. Their demographic was children, and people weren't taking the book seriously. Stan would frequently tell people at parties he was a writer of children's stories and try to avoid the word comic as much as possible. Stan met the love of his life at a party. He knocked on the front door, and Joan answered. Stan was there to meet a different girl, but after just one look, he said to her, "Hello, I think I'm going to fall in love with you." She thought, "This one, I can't let get away." Joan and Stan married before Christmas in 1947. In the 1950s, comics were becoming a more popular industry. Many of the books contained graphic tales of horror and showed violent scenes. The industry was still on shaky ground. They were struggling to find their audience and were under the scrupulous eyes of censors. Timely went through a branding change and turned into Atlas Comics. Stan's time wasn't completely consumed by costumed heroes. His family life started its own expansion, and in 1950, Joan and Stan had their daughter, Joni. It was a trepidatious time for comics. In 1954, the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency opened an investigation. A psychiatrist by the name of Frederick Wortham targeted comics, blaming them for children's misbehaving. They banned horror and crime comics. To respond to the concerns of parents, publishers rallied and formed the Comics Code. They had to implement certain guidelines, like good always had to prevail over evil. Slang terminology could be used, but not excessively. Terms like horror and terror could not be used in the titles. One of my favorites was no ghouls, no walking dead, no vampires. It got very specific. Werewolves could be used in the comic books, however. Even with these rules in place, the damage was done, and sales of comic books plummeted. The surviving books, including Martin Goodman's Atlas Comics, were safe, but far from imaginative. In the early 1960s, Stan was still working for Atlas Comics. But comics weren't really going anywhere at the time. He was contemplating leaving the industry altogether. Seeing her husband in distress, Joan turned to Stan and said, "Why don't you create characters that you like, rather than writing for children because your boss wants you to?" In 1961, Atlas Comics officially transitioned into Marvel Comics. Stan Lee collaborated on the Fantastic Four under the new publisher's title. It was a response to the success of DC Comics' Justice League of America. Jack Kirby was the artist on the books. The Fantastic Four was aimed at an older audience, rather than their 12-year-old demographic. They had breakups, inner demons, and struggled with the dichotomy of being superheroes. In May 1962, the Incredible Hulk made his first appearance. Stan Lee turned to Jack Kirby and pitched him the idea to do a monster book, but he wanted the monster to be friendly looking. Stan told him he needed him to be handsome and sympathetic looking so readers would stand behind him. Bruce Banner became one of Marvel's most popular heroes. Lee and Kirby also collaborated with Stan's brother, artist Larry Lieber, to create the Thor books, based on the Norse mythology. With the success of The Emotional Monster and The Fantastic Four, Marvel was able to recruit incredible talent like Steve Ditko, John Buscema, and John Romita. The collaboration was called the Marvel Method. Stan would discuss the concept with the artist. The artist would then draw the character without reading any script. The art would be drawn in pencil, and Stan would then add the dialogue in the captions. By allowing the artist's imagination to be guided by the writer and then polished with the dialogue, they were able to write more books in a shorter amount of time. Between 1961 and 1962, Marvel sales exploded from 7 to 13 million copies. This was the birth of the Silver Age of comics. Alan Bellman remembers what it was like working under such tight conditions.
Stan was a guy that was very precise and would always look at your artwork carefully. He was, if he had to criticize you, he would. Now, you got to imagine this. This is a young gentleman that is brought in to govern an industry that will grow in enormous in time to come. And there is no one in the capacity of the comic book world that did what Stan Lee did.
Spider-Man made his debut in the 1962 book Amazing Stories. The series was planned to be axed, but Lee developed the character with Steve Ditko. Stan hated teenage sidekicks and wanted to create a character who was the hero in his stories. Stan has said he enjoyed developing the Spider-Man series more than any other series he was involved with. Spider-Man was unique because he not only had his villains to beat, but also battled with responsibilities, low self-esteem, puberty, school relationships, and therefore he was much more relatable to Marvel's target audience. Sandy Fries remembers why the character of Peter Parker resonated with him.
Peter Parker's engaging and compelling and dramatic and interesting because Peter Parker is not Peter Parker. Peter Parker is the viewer. You know, when I first read about Peter Parker in comic books, he was kind of awkward and shy, and I was kind of awkward and shy. And 90% of humanity is awkward and shy, so you see yourself in the character. And one of the top things people are interested in, you know, there's money, there's friends, but one of the top things people are interested in is themselves. So in Peter Parker, you're seeing yourself up there on the screen. And then you see him transform into Spider-Man with the costume where he's quipping and funny and beating the bad guys. And you're thinking, yeah, that's cool. I want to do that too. And the character is constructed in such a way that you can identify with that character. You know, he was dating, I think it was Mary Jane. At times, I think Gwen Stacy was his girlfriend. So it deals with relationship issues, which everybody has. So I guess it's okay to be the way I am, because Peter's like that. So I'm not alone. It's just like my life. So I think that's why. You know, in addition to that, there's the fun part. You know, he shoots webs, which is cool. He swings around from buildings, which is fun. So it's entertainment dash a lesson on how to live your life. But the lesson on how to live your life is the most powerful part of the story and the story that hooks you in.
In 1971, Stan introduced an anti-drug storyline to The Amazing Spider-Man. He realized that young people were taking their values and morals from these books, and he wanted this to resonate. In 1963, Lee and Lieber collaborated again to create the ethically torn Iron Man. He premiered 5 years before in the series Tales of Suspense. In the same year, the original X-Men made their debut. A new group of superhero mutant outcasts would grow to be hated by modern society and fight to be recognized and respected. Another collaboration of Kirby and Lee. As the characters became more popular, Kirby was drowning under the demand. Stan reassigned the X-Men to other artists, but they were no Jack Kirby. The comic continued to change hands, and the work evolved and improved, and took on a whole new life. Eventually, after dominating newsstands with incredible characters and a vast new universe, Lee and Kirby brought their creations together and developed The Avengers. The crossover was an explosive success and allowed the superheroes to dip in and out of storylines and appear in each other's books. At the end of many of his books, Lee would feature a letter to the editor, where a fan would write Marvel and Lee would respond. He made his responses personal, offering advice and often acting as a mentor to his fans. He ended each letter with his catchphrase, "Excelsior." Before Sandy Fries met and worked with Stan, he wrote to him.
I used to read Marvel and write Stan little letters about this character, that character, this book or that book, and he'd send me back little blue postcards sometimes with a one-sentence note, and he'd sign it Stan. I remember that vividly because it made it that much more cool when I met him in person. But he did that. He connected with fans. He connected with me when I was a kid. You know, it was a little blue postcard, but I still remember the color, still remember his signature. And when I met him, he was just as approachable, just as nice, just as down to earth, just as cool. I never, ever got a sense from him that he took himself overly seriously. And there are a lot of people whose names I won't mention in the entertainment business who think of themselves very highly when they possibly or probably shouldn't. You know, Stan was grounded, he was down to earth, he was friendly, he was approachable, he was smart, he was successful. Very, very, very cool guy.
These letters developed Stan's image as the face and persona behind Marvel. This would become the spark that ignited the feud between Lee, Kirby, and Ditko. Lee was a collaborator in Marvel's iconic characters, but credit was not equally distributed amongst the creators, as it should have been. After the break, we'll hear about how this omnipotent editor addressed racial inequality in his characters and fought for the integrity of comics. This episode of A Life Lived is brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands and thousands of amazing classes covering dozens of creative and entrepreneurial skills for people just like you. I love Skillshare. It's like the Netflix of learning, the open university for the 21st century. I've been indulging my inner Stan Lee with a class on character illustration and learning how to draw faces and figures and clothing and inking and shading. I mean, I'm not quite ready to launch the new Peter Parker on the world, but, you know, there's still plenty of time. And because you listen to A Life Lived, you can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today and get 2 months for free by heading to skillshare.com/life. That's access to over 30,000 online classes for free at skillshare.com/life. I mean, what are you waiting for? skillshare.com/LIFE. This episode of A Life Lived is also brought to you by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. For 170 years, it's been covering a range of subjects, from politics and business to science, technology, and the arts, and much, much, much more. Now, The Economist, of course, wrote a stunning obituary on Stan Lee when he passed in November of 2018. And they also had a great read a few months ago about how the Marvel Cinematic Universe is, after 21 movies in 11 years, making its move to conquer the small screen. I mean, Stan Lee's artistic legacy continues to live on and on. The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free copy now by texting the word LIVED to 78070. That's LIVED to 78070. By the late 1960s, Marvel Publishing moved to Madison Avenue, and their staff were quickly outgrowing their surroundings. Flo Steinberg, former proofreader and secretary, would have to corral the chaos in the crazy artistic environment. She described Stan's creative process as he ran around acting out scenes for the books, brainstorming with the artists. In the 60s and 70s, comics were able to experiment with characters and plots in a way that mainstream literature wasn't permitted. They wrote stories where women, disabled people, and Black people were heroes and fighting for those who couldn't fight for themselves. Jack Kirby created the Black Panther at a time when Black people were nowhere in sight in comics. He was powerful and virtuous. Shortly after, this inspired Luke Cage to be added to the Fantastic Four. Comics were popular, but by no means were they respected. They weren't seen as valued literature. Children appreciated the vivid artwork and the complicated characters, the story arcs and the human side. But the art world, the literary world, and critics would still look down on them as child's play. Stan became the spokesperson for comic notoriety. The gap between him and Jack Kirby became cavernous. Both Lee and Kirby publicly spoke out against the extent of Lee's contributions to the beloved characters. Years of dispute over creation and writing percolated and finally erupted. Ditko left Marvel in 1966, and Kirby left in 1970. This never stifled Lee's passion for Marvel and his determination to expand its success. Stan became less and less a collaborator and more the face of Marvel. The innocence of comics shifted, and the children who were once reading the comics had now grown up and were making them. They made storylines more gritty, violent, and often killed off beloved characters. Stan Lee and Marvel were at the top of their game. He wanted to open the public's eyes to their work. He would give speeches at symposiums likening their work to classic artists. In one speech, he described comics as if Michelangelo and William Shakespeare got together and made a comic book. Who would dare read it and not describe it as fine art? Stan wanted to expand Marvel's reach, and in 1977, he decided to cross paths between the Marvel Universe and reality. He brought the world-famous rock group Kiss into the pages of a world where anything is possible. When Marvel was expanding into TV, he was in the driving seat. He was the narrator for both the live-action Incredible Hulk and the animated series Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. His first film cameo was as a jury foreman in the 1989 movie The Trial of the Incredible Hulk. His second cameo was during a Spider-Man crossover with the animated series Muppet Babies. In 1981, Marvel moved from Manhattan to Hollywood. Sandy Fries remembers meeting the Marvel icon.
When I grew up, I remember Spider-Man I liked a lot, Fantastic Four I liked a lot. I remember reading Iron Man, Daredevil as a kid. So here was a guy who created or co-created a lot of those characters, and surprisingly, I was not awed, I was not nervous, it's just, I'm meeting this guy, and we both do things in the entertainment business, no nervousness, nothing. And he was a very down-to-earth, approachable, nice guy. So there was nothing at all to make me nervous. You know, very approachable, very non-look-at-me, I'm important kind of a guy. He was not like that at all. So it was just really nice. And obviously, I remember thinking, you know, very, very cool. I'm meeting one of my heroes.
One of the first films produced from a Marvel character was George Lucas's Howard the Duck. The film bombed, but it has become a cult classic with talks of a remake. Comics began to take on a new meaning. They were no longer the beloved books of children. They became valuable pieces of property. Adults were trying to relive their childhoods through them. Younger people began buying them as future investments. Rare copies were selling for thousands of dollars. Marvel Films was established in the late 80s. They started with Spider-Man, the animated series, and it was a hit. They had tried to bring Spider-Man to screens 3 times before, but this time, Stan was in charge, and he swore to get it right. For a boss, Stan was surprisingly laid back. Sandy remembers an incident that, under different circumstances, could have gone south quite quickly.
I was going to Marvel Studios for a meeting, and I was kind of in a rush because there was heavy traffic and, you know, the meeting was minutes away. So I'm at Marvel Studios. They have a bunch of parking spots right outside the front door of the Marvel building. And I just see a spot where I say to myself, wow, there's a spot right next to the door. That is so cool. I zoom right into the spot, get out of the car, run into the meeting. The meeting was with producer on a new show that they were working on. And, you know, the meeting runs about 10 minutes before somebody comes in the room after 10 minutes and says, Sandy, where did you park? I said, oh, I got this great space. It was right next to the main door. It was so cool. I guess it was my lucky day. And the person said, Sandy, you parked in Stan Lee's parking spot. And I was rushing so much I didn't see his name on the floor. You know, they'll stencil names on the floor. I parked in a spot, which was a very stupid thing to do. And he did not get upset with me. He totally did not even care. But there you go. I parked in Stanley's parking spot. And the meeting was interrupted. I had to take a break to move my car. When I came back embarrassed, we continued the meeting, and I felt like an idiot. But I should have connected that if you get a spot right near the front door and it's empty, it might be Stanley's parking spot. But it did not connect. But the nice part about it is he totally didn't care. It was no big deal. The person who came in to interrupt the meeting seemed more shaken and caring than Stan did. You know, as far as he was concerned, no big deal. You know, we were still friends and everything was fine. How somebody reacts to that kind of thing tells you volumes about their personality and their character. You know, how you deal with adversity, you either let it grind on you and get angry, or you laugh.
X-Men joined the cartoon craze, and the two series became the most popular shows on Fox Network. In 1995, Stan would play a cameo role in Kevin Smith's sophomore film, Mallrats. He offers love advice to the film's sex-obsessed anti-hero Brody when he loses his way. Stan was a romantic and often gave relationship advice to those he cared about. Sandy remembers confiding in his friend.
If you're going to take advice from somebody, Stan Lee is certainly a guy to take advice from. He would give me advice about dating and marriage and that kind of stuff, and I talked to him about relationships. So it was both professional and non-professional. But, you know, when we talked, it was like getting into a conversation with a good friend. You know, Sandy, you should try dating this kind of person. Yeah, this one would be good, that one wouldn't be good, and this is what you should look for, and this is what you should avoid, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it got pretty personal.
Stan was slowly being pushed out of Marvel. He was acting more as a spokesperson and being credited in films rather than credited on the cover of their books. In 1998, Stan Lee created the Stan Lee Media Company. They secured the rights to Conan the Barbarian and developed a brief digital webisode called The Seventh Portal. When the company didn't really take off, he launched POW Entertainment. Through this company, he developed films, books, TV, and plenty of international content. He created superheroes based on sports teams. He launched a reality show called Stan Lee's Superhumans and even had a YouTube channel. With the 2000 release of X-Men and the 2002 release of Spider-Man, Stan fought Marvel over royalties. Marvel settled with Stan and offered him a hefty lump fee. He missed out on the monumental opportunity to bank on what would grow to be a movie conglomerate. Instead, he made sure his presence was known by having a cameo in every Marvel film made. In 2017, Stan's wife Joan passed away after complications from a stroke. They were married for 69 years. The loss was devastating, and rumors about Stan's welfare spread. Despite personal devastation, Stan continued to make public appearances with his shiny grin. In 2018, Stan had to have nurses with him 24 hours a day. This limited his ability to appear in cameos for the Marvel films. He was only able to commute to sets in the California area. Stan Lee passed away on November 12, 2018. He was 95 years old.
Hard to beat the kind of life he had. You know, he enjoyed what he did. He loved what he did. Millions of people loved him. He communicated with millions of people. He enjoyed the process. You got to say to yourself, it's terribly sad, but he did a phenomenal job of being alive.
The comic world wailed in grief. Celebrities shared their consolations over social media. Disney paid homage to their real-life hero. Even DC Comics honored their greatest rival by putting a black armband around the arm of a sculpture of Superman in Metropolis, Illinois. Before he passed away, he was able to make an appearance in Marvel's Into the Spider-Verse and Avengers Endgame.
I think his legacy is leaving a bunch of heroes who teach readers and movie viewers how to be heroes in their own life. You know, how do you be a hero? You do things the way Peter Parker does. You're awkward with this. You're self-conscious about that. But you overcome it. You face it. You deal with it. So I think his legacy is leaving kind of a set of examples through characters on how to most effectively live your life. And that example is read or viewed by millions and millions of people all over the world. So that's an amazing legacy to live. He has affected the brain chemistry, the values, the lessons of millions of people's lives for the better.
Stan was able to achieve the respect and notoriety he fought for his entire life through Marvel and Excelsior.
You know, it was one thing that occurs to me. I remember when he passed away, the newspaper that I read about him passing away had a big photo of him at one of the Spider-Man movie premieres, and he was smiling, and he was in the Spider-Man pose, and he had his fingers in the I'm-going-to-shoot-web kind of pose. Humans can be superheroes too. He was super.
If you want to know more about what went on in Marvel's offices, you can read all about it in Alan Bellman's book, Timely Confidential, available on Amazon. Sandy Fries takes us through galaxies of memories alongside Stan Lee and Gene Roddenberry in his book, Secrets Your Textbook Will Not Tell You About, TVs, Movies, and Life. Also available on Amazon. Next time on A Life Lived.
The whole thing was they had to paint a certain part of the set, and Cameron turned to Bill and said, "Hey, you," because Bill was hanging around, and he said, "Can you paint?" And Bill was like, "Yeah," and he goes, "Well, here," stuck a brush in his hand and said, "Paint this," and they became like very, very dear, close friends. Yeah.
Bill told me, did he tell you about working on a porn shoot, and he was the cleanup guy.
Okay, I need to tell you this. You can't open with that and not tell the story.
James Cameron took him to outer space and the deepest parts of the ocean. But Bill Paxton's friends tell us how he got started with a paintbrush and a bucket. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Assistant produced by Paige Waller. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.